Elizabeth Barrett Browning said, "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach." William Shakespeare said, "Love is an ever-fixed mark. It looks upon the tempest and is never shaken." Robert Burns says, "My love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. My love is like a melody that's sweetly played in tune." Many beautiful words have been written down through the history of humanity in an attempt to describe just what love is, or how strongly we feel in our love toward another, or how we would describe the one who loves us. But no words ever put to pen have ever been more beautiful than those found in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And it is to those words that we give our attention today. Would you please open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 13 and let us read that beautiful passage. Paul says, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect has come, then that which is part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as also I am known. And now abide faith, hope, and love, these three. But the greatest of these is love." As I think of that powerful and wonderful description of love given by the Apostle Paul, I think it naturally divides into three descriptions, three areas. It seems to me that Paul talks about the greatness of love, the beauty of love, and the endurance of love. And it's those three things that I'd like to think about for a few moments today: the greatness, the beauty, and the endurance of love. First of all, he begins talking about the greatness of love. Himfelt, Minnerth, and Meyer, in their book Love is a Choice, it's a book dealing with addiction and codependency. And one of the key things they stress at the beginning of their book is that every human child that comes into the world with a built-in need to love and to be loved. A built-in need to feel like they matter in the world. And these psychologists say that if that child does not receive that growing up, they will bear the scars of that the rest of their lives. Maybe that's why the Bible talks so much about love. If we look at the leading noun and verb for love in the Bible, agapao is our verb, agape is our noun. As we look at those two words in the New Testament, combined they're found over 250 times in the New Testament. There have been many descriptions of it, but basically it's a love of the will. Not a love of the emotions, not a love of biological connection like in a family, but it's a love of the will. It's a choice of the heart, not an emotion of the heart. Dave Roper, I think, had one of the best descriptions of agape love when he said, agape love says, I love you. Not I love you if, not I love you because, but just I love you. In other words, it's a love that says, I'll love you even if you don't do what I want you to do. It's a love that is present even if I don't have a number of causes. I just choose to love you. And it's that word that Paul describes over and over here in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And it's interesting what Paul does, because he began in chapter 12, and really chapter 12 through 14, as we've talked about, this section of 1 Corinthians deals with the manifestation of miraculous spiritual gifts. And the divisions that were taking place over it, the confusion in the next chapter over what was happening in the worship place because a lot of different people had these miraculous abilities. And so it's interesting as you think about chapter 12, apparently they were dividing and fighting over gifts. Some people thought they were better than others because they had certain gifts, or maybe others Christians didn't have gifts at all. Some of those who maybe didn't have spiritual miraculous gifts, or maybe theirs they didn't feel was as good as somebody else's, they felt like they didn't matter. And so he uses this analogy of a body. And he says every part matters, and every part is in the body right where God wanted it. It's God's design. I can't take credit for anything I have anyway. And so nobody's better than anybody else, and nobody's less important than anybody else. But he does, as he ends the chapter, he does point out that there may be some gifts. For example, he's going to emphasize the gift of prophecy. And so he's going to challenge them, you know, desire the greater gifts. Now they seem to have gotten all caught up on the gift of tongues. Now Paul, for example, at the end of chapter 12, puts tongues at the bottom of his list of gifts. They put it at the top. He said, if you're going to fight over which gift's a good one to have, I'd have the gift of prophecy, Paul says. That's how he ends chapter 12. But he says, let me tell you this. There is a more excellent way. There is a better way. That word excellent is an interesting word. It literally means to throw beyond. I think about when I grew up going to a church camp at Mid-South Youth Camp. So they're all 45 in between Jackson, Tennessee and Henderson, Tennessee. Went there from the time I was 11 or 12 till I graduated high school. But I can remember we would have these competitions during the week, maybe free throw shooting or running or swimming or diving or whatever. And they'd give out ribbons for them. And I remember one of our competitions was throwing a softball. Who could throw a softball farther than anybody else? And it's interesting to me that Paul's described all these incredible gifts, these incredible things that people can do by the power of God. But he says there's one that goes further than all the rest of them, that's cast far beyond. And that something is love. And he says, let me tell you just how great love is. He says, it's so great that, and then he starts listing miraculous gifts, and then he moves beyond miraculous gifts just to things people do in service to God. He talks about speaking in tongues. He talks about divinely given knowledge and understanding. In other words, I'm able to understand things and know things miraculously that I wouldn't know by my own effort. He talks about a superhuman faith. He talks about a faith that could move mountains. And that's all people who are Christians have faith. But he says some were given by God an extra measure of faith so that they could hold tough in incredibly difficult times. Now, why would that be important? Because in the early church, you've got people that are dying for their faith. And they're going to be incredible tests to their faith. And so if they can have some Christians in the congregation that have been given a little extra power by God to hang in there, then everybody else can say, they can do it, let's hang in there. And so you've got to have somebody in the crowd saying, don't quit. Hang in there. Don't give up. God seems to have, in the first century, miraculously gave few people that power. He says, though I have all of these things, but I don't love God or people. what good is it? He said, if I can speak in the tongues of men and angels, and you're going to consistently find in the New Testament, we go all the way back to Acts chapter 2, when they spoke of tongues, they were human languages. When they spoke in tongues on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, people understood what they were saying because the people spoke those languages. You had Jews from all over the known earth. How are you going to communicate in a crowd that has multiple languages? Well, you have people with multiple abilities to speak those languages. But he says, if I could speak in all the languages of men, and could even speak in the language of angels. I don't love. He said, I'm just so much noise. I was reminded in talking to James Allen, he was talking about his mother, Miss Catherine. Sister Bryant had this old antique piano at her house. And she didn't let anybody touch that antique piano except her little grandkids, Alan and Elena. And they had freedom to bang around on that old antique piano all they wanted to. I can think about times when we're at my parents' house, and I can vividly remember and seeing videos. And in fact, recently we kind of converted a bunch of our old VHC videos over to DVD, and so we were watching back through some of those. And I can remember the grandkids sitting on the little piano chair in front of my mom's piano, just banging away. And I remember thinking, man, that's just the cutest thing in the world for about the first 30 seconds. But you know, after about an hour and a half of that, you can't hear, you can't think. You're hunting for work to do outside of the house. You know what Paul says? He said, I may speak all kinds of languages, I may speak in the language of angels, but if I don't have love, I'm only so much noise. He said, if I give everything I have to the poor, he said, if I'm willing to be tied to a stake and burned for Christ, but I don't love, he said, what good is it to me? He said, it profits me nothing. Folks, that's pretty strong language. What Paul is saying is, he's not saying these other things aren't wonderful gifts or good things to do. But he says love, love does not undergird and motivate and substantiate everything we do, it's useless. People can do good things for bad reasons. And he says, you know, sometimes we may give away our money because we think somehow that's going to earn heaven for us. But he says, if I give all my money away and I don't love people, I might as well have kept the money because it profits me nothing. Love is the greatest gift. So that means if I have the gift, ability to sing, to lead singing or whatever, and I think I'm better than somebody else, or I get upset over how often I get to lead singing, it profits me nothing. Though I'm the best of Bible class teachers, or I preach the gospel, if I don't love those I teach, then it's only so much noise. Though I work every day and volunteer my time over in the Benevolence Center, giving things away, though I give money for a children's home in India, though I every other month go on mission trips around the globe, if I don't love, then it's wasted time and wasted money. Because love is the greatest gift. Then he describes the beauty of love. In reality, many times seeing is believing. We need to see love. And so it seems to me he draws us a mental picture of what love is. 16 things he uses to describe love. 7 of them are positive. 9 of them are negative. On the positive side, he says things like love suffers long. You might reverse that and just say that love is long in its suffering. In other words, love is willing to suffer with much. Love is long in its temper. Love is willing to put up with much in the faults of others. Love is kind. In other words, it means that love seeks to do what is to the benefits of another person. He talks about the fact that love focuses on truth. and rejoices in truth, rejoices when good is done, rejoices when truth prevails, rejoices when God's Word spreads across the earth. He says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The idea of bear, again, is that idea referring back to what he began with, the idea of bearing under insult, bearing up under injury, enduring what others do to us without retaliating. Believing either means love never stops having faith, or it, I think more aptly and probably, means love believes and looks for the best in people. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. It not only looks for the best in people, it looks for the best in life. It looks at life through the eyes of faith in God. It has a confident expectation of the future, especially the future as it is in the hands of the Creator of the universe. Love endures. It doesn't matter what happens to love, love will not quit. And that's exactly what Shakespeare was saying. He said, love's an ever-fixed mark. It looks upon the tempest. It never quits. It never gives up. It never caves in. Love endures all things. But you know, sometimes you understand what something is by understanding what it's not. And so it's interesting to me that Paul spends most of his time talking about what love isn't. And let's just notice some of the things he says. He said, love does not envy. Love doesn't want what another person has. Love is not jealous when another person succeeds. I'm reminded of the last chapter when he says that we, in the body, when one suffers, all suffer. When one rejoices, all rejoice. You see, arrogance and pride doesn't react that way. Arrogance says, ah, they're having trouble. Glad it's not me. I must be doing something right. Or, why were they noticed? I should have had that reward. That's what arrogance does. But love is not jealous of another's success or another's possessions. It says love does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. Literally, the idea is like a swelling balloon. I'm swelled up with pride. And because I'm so swelled with pride, I brag about myself. I want everybody to know just how great I am. He says love doesn't behave rudely. You see, a person that's consumed with self does whatever they want. Because they don't care what anybody else thinks. They don't care what anybody else needs. They don't care whose feelings they hurt or what belongs to somebody else. Life for them is all about themselves. So they do whatever they want. And they shame their families and they shame their God. He says, love does not seek its own. The person who loves is out. Remember, what kindness means is to do something to help somebody else. Love is not saying, okay, what can I get out of this? Or, why didn't I get that? Love is thinking, man, I wish I could give more. I wish I had more to give. What can I do to help you? It doesn't matter what I go without. I just want you to be happy. I want you to have what you need. He says, love is not provoked. The word literally comes from a root word that means to sharpen. Okay, you ever remember those times when you're driving down the road with the kids in the back? Sally's touching me. Johnny poked me. Mom, he won't leave me alone. And then when you say something to them, if you'll watch every once in a while, you look in the back seat and they do this number. Now, you know what I'm talking about? They don't actually touch each other, but they'll hold their finger 1 inch away just to drive the other one crazy. That's what Paul's talking about. There are always going to be people in life that will poke us and they'll prod us and they'll irritate us to try to make us angry. He says you can't do that to love. You can poke love all you want to. The person who loves, doesn't matter what you do to me, jab me all you want. I will not be provoked to anger and wrath and ungodliness. He says, love thinks no evil. Thinks of no evil. The word literally, it's an accounting term for the keeping of records and the totaling up of money. What he's saying is that a person who loves doesn't add up all the mistakes of the other person. Well, now, honey, you've done this to me 16 times this week. It doesn't hold on to all the wrongs ever done to them. I want you to think about that. There's some of us here this morning who were hurt by somebody 20 years ago, and we still think about it on a weekly basis. Some of us think about things on a daily basis. Paul says, love tears the page out of the ledger. Love doesn't add up other people's wrongs. Thinks no evil. Rejoices not in iniquity. Love doesn't rejoice when somebody messes up. Can we do that sometimes? I want you to think about it. Sometimes for us, the Christian life becomes a competition. And we look at our spirituality in terms of how everybody else is doing. So, you know, Joe over here, or Sally or Sue or whoever, if they mess up, it makes me look better. It makes me feel better about my Christianity. So when we find out somebody else in the congregation is really messed up, said, oh, I knew they never were really committed. I knew they really didn't believe. Love doesn't rejoice. Love doesn't say, I told you so. Love doesn't arrogantly think, okay, I'm better than you. I didn't do that. Love weeps. Love has a broken heart. Love reaches out an arm and hugs them about the shoulder and says, what can I do to help? Because I mess up too. Love does not rejoice in iniquity, but love rejoices in the truth. It's a beautiful, beautiful depiction of what love is. And it's a radically new way to live. I started back to school about a year ago, and I remember on our first day of orientation, there are 12 of us in my group going through together. There's another 12 ahead of them. There'll be another 12 behind us, and we go through the program together. I remember the first day as they were meeting with us, they met with the whole group and then kind of dismissing and just talking to those of us that were new. And they said, we want everything competitive that you've ever learned in education, we want you to forget it. Because it will not be a part of this program. We don't want it to be a part of this program. I want you to think about, and this is not a dissertation on education, this is a dissertation on love, but maybe the application will help. They talk about the fact that in most of our education is built on competition. It's all about outdoing somebody else, being in the top 10%, or the top 5%, or the top 2%, or being salutatorian, or being valedictorian. If you know something that could put you above somebody else, don't you dare share it with them. You keep it to yourself. It's all about competition. And so they said, hey, this program doesn't function on competition. You'll be graded, you'll have to do your own work, etc., etc., but we want you to view this as a team effort. So if you're working on a paper and you found some incredible source that you think everybody in your cohort needs for that paper, you tell them. Now folks, I'm just going to tell you, I don't work any less than I did on any other degree. I work just as hard. In fact, I would dare say harder. But it is a radically new way to do education. You know what I think Paul's saying? He's saying everything you've ever learned about how to live life, competition, one-upping everybody else, trying to improve on being better than everybody else. He said, you forget everything you've learned about how to live. Because when it comes to living in my kingdom, we are a team. We help each other. We love each other. We don't rejoice in each other's hurts. Our hearts break with each other's hurts. Having then talked about the greatness and beauty of love, he talks about the durability of love. Summed up in that phrase at the beginning of verse 8, which is really kind of transition from section 2 to section 3. But he says, love never fails. The word literally means love doesn't fall. Love doesn't fall down, but it's a strong and mighty structure that stands throughout time. I was reminded of when I visited Paris, France. Everything there is several hundred years old. France was occupied. France wasn't bombed during World War II. It didn't have to deal with all the blitzkriegs and so forth that they dealt with in London. So in Paris, everything's been there a long time. And so Paul says, we've got some wonderful gifts given by God. But he said, the one that'll never fall, the one that'll never be blown up, the one that'll never be torn down, is love. But he says, now all these other things, they're going to end. Prophecies, they'll end. Tongues, they'll end. Divine knowledge, it'll end. All of those things are destined to stop. If you look down through there, the word fail in verse 8, the words vanish away in verse 8, the word done away in verse 10, and the word put away in verse 11 are all the same Greek word. And it means to perish, to cease, or to cut something off and separate it and make it of no effect. He has one word he uses differently in there. The word cease there in the New King James is a word just means stop. And so you have a contrast here. He says love will never fall. But these other things, they'll be cut off. They'll cease. They'll be separated and done away with. They'll stop. He says they were never intended to last. We're going to talk next week about what the perfect is. He says these things will be done away with when the perfect comes. So we'll talk about that next week because it's going to take more time than I can do this morning. But what he's saying is that there is something designed to stand and never fall, and there were some other things designed to stop. He says these miraculous abilities, they were never intended to last. He said, in fact, he associates them with spiritual immaturity. They are a sign of immaturity. They are things that are necessary for an immature church to grow. And he says, when I was a child, I spoke and understood and thought like a child. But I'm not a child anymore, so I put away childish things. And so he says, these childish things that they're all fighting about, he said, they're going to be done away with. So why are you fighting over something that are childish? Or are you fighting over something, things that were never intended to last? He said, now faith, hope, and love, these three, they remain, he says in verse 13. He says, those three things will remain, continue, and stand firm. It seems to me in comparison, he's saying that however long miracles last, they won't last as long as faith, hope, and love. Faith, hope, and love, they'll endure. Miraculous gifts will not. But he says, the greatest of those things that will remain is love. Because love is one thing that will never fail. Even faith and hope will end at the doorstep of eternity. Because faith and hope end in sight of the throne of God. When you move from faith to sight, there's no longer a need to believe in the unseen. For it has now become the seen. Would you take out your song books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? Paul is saying that the greatest thing in life is love. It's the greatest gift. I want you to look at a picture up here, and I want you to take that verse we just looked at, and everywhere you have the word love, I want you to insert the word Jesus. Would it be true? Was Jesus long-suffering? Was Jesus kind? Did Jesus think no evil? Did Jesus bear all things? Yes. Now let's pull up another slide. Let's take this same verse, and everywhere the word love is, stick your name, and I'll stick mine. Is Kurt patient? Is Kurt kind? Does Kurt bear all things, hope all things, endure all things? Does that verse apply to us? If it doesn't, it's time to do something about it. As we sing this invitation song, I hope you'll come and express your faith in repentance, confession, and baptism. Why? Because Jesus Christ loved us enough to forgive us our faults and go to the cross of Calvary. And if there are some of us here this morning who are Christians, who realize that, yes, I may have done many good things, I come to services regularly, read my Bible, pray, and give them to the benevolence program, but I don't love like I ought to, then now's the time to change as we stand and sing.